This week, my mother-in-law died. She was the last of her generation in our family. Her funeral was on Friday, which was also her granddaughter's birthday. So we shared a day that literally marked the passing of life from generation to generation. Writing the obituary, we had to recall and name other ancestors. Ancestor finding and genealogies have been of interest to people from forever, as we just heard. And with the availability of modern research tools, that interest has been fed and heightened. And people today that do a root search can testify that we all have noble blood and we're all descended from horse thieves. Jesus' genealogy, as recorded in Matthew's gospel, is like that. Now, an important function of genealogies is to legitimize claims of inheritance or title. And the genealogy of Jesus Messiah is meant to do just that. It's rooted in Israel's whole history. It goes back to Father Abraham, to whom God promised that through him and his line, all the nations of the world would be blessed. And it sets up Jesus as the fulfillment of that promise. It traces his line through King David, the shepherd king of Israel, whose golden era the Messiah was expected to reprise. The Messiah was to sit on a throne, the throne of David, and rule with righteousness. Matthew groups Jesus' ancestors into three sets, each mirroring the three epochs in Israel's history: the patriarchal kingdom, the exile, and the return. And each set is put into 14, or twice the holy number 7, of generations. Matthew is shouting to us that God's divine plan is orderly, and that all of this has been planned since the beginning to culminate in the birth of Jesus Messiah. But then Matthew doesn't quit while he's ahead. No, he disorders his genealogy by including the women in it who had shady pasts. Instead of the sainted mother Sarah, he includes Tamar, who pretended to be a prostitute to beget the heir that the law entitled her to. And then there's Rahab, the Canaanite spy, with whom marriage was forbidden. Oh, and sweet little Ruth, a Moabitess, whose people came from the incestuous cesspit of Sodom, and who seduced the Israelite Boaz when he was drunk in order to obtain the justice that she was allowed by law. And next comes Bathsheba, a Hittite, the wife of Uriah, whose marriage to the adored King David resulted from adultery and murder. All of this is a lead up to Mary, whose reputation in Matthew's time was under attack, as was Joseph's righteousness in marrying an already pregnant woman. Matthew intends to shock us by inserting chaotic, unsavory elements into his orderly and upright list, and then call it all a part of God's plan. Divine chaos as part and parcel of divine order. Because God is doing a new thing in Jesus. In him, God's proclamation of what it means to be righteous is going to receive a new meaning. In the history of Israel, righteous is a covenantal term depicting the basis on which it's decided if your character is God approved or not. And this is determined by your actions, your attitudes, and your relationships. By their actions, attitudes, and relationships, these women Matthew lists would be deemed unrighteous. But they're the esteemed ancestors in Israel's history. And Matthew is saying, if you're going to reject Mary, you have to reject all of them too. If they're righteous, if their actions are God approved, then so are hers, and so is she. There's a new definition of righteousness coming in the revelation that Jesus brings. Advent means coming. A new thing is coming. Righteousness will mean fitting in with God's plan and setting one's actions, attitudes, and relationships in the order of the divine agenda. And doing so may upend the established order and the human way of doing things. And that may make us uncomfortable. Perhaps you may feel that God's calling you to consider doing things that'll make you uncomfortable, that'll upset your family or your friends. You may need to stick up publicly for a cause or a person that you just like to keep quiet about for the sake of peace and harmony. And yet you hear God calling you to insert chaos into your world order. Or perhaps you're seeing chaos disrupt your world order in the path of nations, in the world news, in local government, in regulations that may be affecting you right now. And from the outside and close up, a lot of what goes on in our world looks disorderly. And you may question, how can God allow it? Matthew opens his gospel by demonstrating how divine order is intertwined with divine disorder. When you're close up, when you're going through slavery in Egypt or exile in Babylon, you can become hopeless and not see God's plan or presence in the disorder. But it's kind of like those impressionistic paintings where if you stand up close to them, they just look like little blobs of color. But if you stand back, you can see the design, the picture. And so stepping back from our view of life and history and what's going on can help us perceive God's plan. And that's a little hard to do when you're living it right now. And so that's where faith and trust come in. The events in our current history, whether on the world stage or in the microcosm of our lives, might look like that painting, a chaotic world. And so our faith in God's advent into the chaos helps us to trust that there is a satisfying order that'll become apparent in the final advent. What's hard is maintaining that faith and trust as we live between the advents of the advent of God's breaking into the world in Jesus with that promise and God's fulfillment of it. We live between a lot of advents. The advent of God's inbreaking birth in Jesus and the advent of God's inbreaking presence into our lives. And the advents that are celebrated in this season and the anticipated advent of Christ that will break into this old world and reveal the new. And all these advents are wrapped up together in our waiting. Waiting's hard. And the impatient child in us wants to open all the doors on the advent calendar today and force Jesus to come and complete our Christmas joy. But we can't rush God's time. God's promised a fantastic future for us to look forward to, when everyone will live in unadulterated joy, a time when there's no need for patience. Yet because what we often see is chaos, it's hard to see God's order and control at work, to see the ideal in a world of stark reality. On one hand, we want to be with the prophet Isaiah, the idealist who speaks into a chaotic time of Israel's history, a speech that to his hearers must have sounded ridiculously improbable. Soon, the deserts are blossoming, and everything is going to be rosy. And on the other hand, we're realists, like the Bible writer of James, who counsels patience in suffering, suffering that's going to go on into the foreseeable future. Our everyday data from the news of earthquakes and wars, and the data from our lives, tell us that suffering's a reality. Reality is waiting for test results from the doctor, mourning the death of a loved one, wondering if we'll make it through the next round of layoffs. We know the data all too well, and we long for a word out of place. We want to hear the call to the feeble knees, the weak hands, the fearful hearts, the call to blind and deaf and lame, the call against the data, a call that refuses to wait until things improve. And so we light our Advent candles as idealists, in defiance of the darkness, and hold on to the promise and share the gift of our eschatological hope. But this promise doesn't mean that God expects us to neglect the gift of today. We're called to be realists too, patient and active as healers in this world, not retreating into spirituality, but giving our realistic gifts of hope, meals and camps and clothes. Like all those people in Jesus' family tree, the honorable and the infamous, God doesn't airbrush out the messiness for us, because some of what looks like it doesn't belong in the picture may turn out to be important pixels in God's plan. Mary looked to her peers like damaged goods, a bit weak and shameful. Matthew reminds us that God used women with shady reputations throughout Israel's history to preserve the royal line. Because righteousness in the new order is not about what people think, but about supporting God's plan for the desert to bloom and for all to be safe and welcome on God's royal highway. Mary may not have looked righteous to her peers, but to us who can see God's bigger picture, she embodies the new righteousness. What looked wrong and chaotic close up then is now gloriously apparent as a great and good gift from God. God is working through our chaos today too. And for that we can say, thanks be to God. Amen.